From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino in for A. Martinez. Thanks for joining us this Thursday. As we march toward a possible teacher strike in Los Angeles, we'll hear from some parents about their concerns and what they're planning for their kids, take them to school or keep them home. Plus, how is the legal pot market shaping up a year in? Maybe a bit too mellow, so to speak. We'll tell you why. That's all coming up. But first, back to that partial government shutdown.
We asked him to give us one good reason. I asked him directly. I said, Mr. President, give me one good reason why you should continue your shutdown of the eight cabinet departments while we are debating our differences on Homeland Security. He could not give a good answer.
That's New York Senator Chuck Schumer yesterday. President Trump invited congressional leaders to the White House for more negotiations to reopen the government. But as you can tell from that clip, not much happened. The two sides are still deadlocked. Meanwhile, agencies are running out of money and our national parks are drowning in trash. In California, Sequoia and Kings Canyon have been closed off entirely because of this. Joshua Tree and Yosemite have remained open largely thanks to a team of volunteers who are helping pick up the garbage and maintain the park. People like Ken Yeager. He's the president of the Yosemite Climbing Association, and he's been organizing cleanups with his staff and volunteers to keep the park beautiful. He joins us now. Welcome, Ken.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I think I speak for a lot of people in saying, no, thank you. Why was it so important for you to do this kind of work?
Well, I'm a resident of the area and have been for about 42 years. I enjoy and use the area. I'm a rock climber and have been for almost 50 years now. And so Yosemite has a really special place in my heart. And it also has a very special place in a lot of people's hearts. So a lot of us are, you know, kind of getting together and trying to take care of the worst of it.
Can you kind of paint a picture for us of the Yosemite that you have been seeing over the past week or so?
Well, it's always very crowded, you know, over the holiday or over the holidays. And so the park was at capacity the last 2 weeks. It's calmed down quite a bit since then. And I was up there yesterday and it was very quiet. The problem was is that every room was being rented and every campground was full. And a lot of the services that the park visitors rely on weren't available. In particular, the biggest problems were closed bathrooms and also trash cans that were at capacity. So people were leaving bags of trash out, and the animals would drag it out in the woods and rip it apart. And so it's very hard to clean up once that's happened. So we decided to get an early start on it, and a lot of people have got the same idea. So I'm not the only one out there. There's a lot of people that are doing this.
How many people do you have helping you out, and what are you doing when you're in the park?
Well, I'm passing out litter sticks. I organize this giant 2,000-3,000-person trash cleanup every year for week-long in September every year called the Yosemite Facelift. So I have all these materials. I have 700 sets of litter sticks, and I've got bags and gloves and safety vests and all that stuff. So I'm just making them, making sure they're available to anybody that wants to come up and kind of clean some of the, you know, the worst of it. That's all. The park is already looking a lot better than it did even like 3 or 4 days ago. So, and I think we got through the worst of it.
Does this bring up deeper issues for you beyond, you know, whenever this shutdown should end?
Well, you know what, this shutdown just really puts, you know, kind of a human challenge or a problem, you know, right at the forefront here. It's not really a political problem. It's more of a human problem. We have problems with trash everywhere. You fly into San Francisco in the airport and you drive up to Yosemite, you can't help but see just piles and piles of trash along the highway or any empty field. And so, you know, we see this stuff everywhere, and, you know, and unfortunately it happens in Yosemite too. It's just that Yosemite being such a special place that it is, it has a lot of caretakers. So, you know, I think education is probably one of the bigger problems here. So a lot of people, you know, they come up here expecting to use these services, and when they're not available, they're not sure how to act or what the proper protocol is in a wilderness area. Essentially, it's a wilderness area now with limited services.
I read a post on Facebook from one park employee that basically said, you know, please don't come to the park until the shutdown ends because of some of these problems that you mentioned. What kind of message would you want to give to people who maybe plan to visit the park soon?
Well, I just want to make sure that everybody realizes these services aren't available. Treat it like you're car camping out in the middle of the desert with no restrooms. In other words, you got to dig a hole to go to the bathroom. You carry your toilet paper out. You carry your trash in, you carry it out, or, you know, food in and then carry your trash out. So it's great. I'd love for people to enjoy the park this time of year. It's beautiful right now. It's cool. It's sunny during the day, brisk in the morning. Just really crisp lighting right now. So it's a beautiful time to come up and take pictures or go for a hike. But, you know, just be aware that some of the bathrooms are closed. And, you know, if you just kind of use better practices in Yosemite, then it wouldn't be a problem.
All right. Ken Yeager, president of the Yosemite Climbing Association. Thanks for joining us and thanks for all your work.
Thank you.
Moving on, as of January 1st, more police records are now available to the public in California. That's because of new state laws going into effect this year. Until now, California had a reputation for being one of the most secretive states in the nation when it comes to police conduct. To talk about what changes, we brought in KPCC's senior investigative reporter, Annie Gilbertson. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Megan.
So, Annie, explain the new laws, because it is laws, plural, right?
Yeah, there are two. So one has to do with police personnel records and investigations, and this is already in effect as of January 1. So we should be able to get records of sustained findings of law enforcement that were found to be lying or to have committed sexual assault. These records had been secret from the public before. Mm-hmm. We should also be able to see investigations into use of force that created great bodily injury or any of the shooting investigations. And I had requested many of those types of records before and been denied many times. Mm-hmm. So this is certainly a change. The second law that should be on everybody's mind is it actually goes into effect in July, so not quite yet, but it's going to open up a lot of video involved in these incidents. So camera, video, audio recordings of officer shootings, other serious use of force incidents, they should be made available to the public within 45 days. That is, unless there is, it would interfere with an investigation or with a criminal proceeding. But that's certainly a totally different tune than what we've seen in the past in California.
Right. So, I mean, do you think that these laws will make a difference in kind of bringing California police conduct out of the dark?
Yeah. Will it ultimately bring conduct out of the dark? We will see how agencies respond to our many requests. You know, California has long been known as one of the most secretive states in the nation when it comes to police conduct. So I'll just give you an example of video. Like, we've seen so much police shooting videos from around the country in the last few years, but very little of it from California. And that's because police departments had the option of whether or not they wanted to release video. And what I saw as a reporter is they would release the video when it looked good and made them look good to the public. Mm-hmm. And they would withhold video when there was a lot more scrutiny around the shootings. So it really begs this question of how are officers being held accountable? And that's a question that I've been exploring, as you know, Megan, for a couple of years right now with the Repeat podcast, where we looked at a string of officer shootings in South LA. This officer shot at 4 people in 7 months, which is a very short period of time to be in that many shootings. And on paper, from what we could see in the public, you know, these were written off as legally justified shootings. That is what the adjudication proceedings had found. But we wondered if there wasn't more to the story there. And ultimately, what we found was this police accountability system that is completely kept in the dark, that is shrouded from the public's view. So oftentimes, there is a panel of top law enforcement that looks at these use of force incidents, that adjudicates what happens, decides whether or not an officer should go back out into the field. And all of those findings are held secret from the public, or were.
Now, there's obviously been a lot of national attention to police shootings in recent years, particularly those of unarmed Black men, really sparking the entire Black Lives Matter movement. Do you think these new laws show that protests are working?
Oh, I mean, undeniably, that conversation has really elevated the discussion throughout the couple of years. I mean, starting with Michael Brown, I think that's what many people look back to as the pivotal moment where people started questioning what was happening with police shootings. I mean, I will make a distinction that these are laws that are making public records more available. These are not laws that are going to necessarily decrease shootings. There was a law like that that was proposed, a piece of legislation in Sacramento last year that did not pass. That would have said, you know, look, officers should only shoot when absolutely necessary. It did not pass. Only these open records laws, which I think the open records law get at another important issue that has been raised to the surface with these protests that you mentioned, which is sort of this undercurrent that, do we trust that law enforcement is properly holding their own accountable when it's done so in secret? So the analogy I like to make is from the Rodney King beating, right? So that video got released. That is not what sparked the protest. What sparked the protest was when the officers were acquitted. And so it offended people's sense of justice. And I think that right now the country is asking, you know, are officers being reasonably held accountable for these use of force? And in California, we couldn't even look deeply at these cases because the records were sealed.
So have you been making use of these laws yet in service of your journalism?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, I started with a list of records requests that I wanted to make January 1. I set a timer for my emails to go out 12 a.m. just right at the new year. And it was too long. My records list was way too long. It was like over 60 different requests. So I tried to narrow it down, definitely trying to be more focused and surgical in what exactly we're asking for. Because frankly, I need to also sleep in 2019. I cannot just read records requests. So we had to narrow that way down. But we have certainly asked for some stuff. Looking back at the podcast and what we couldn't get last year, we're asking for.
And there's already been a challenge to one of these laws, right?
Yeah, law enforcement did not like this legislation when it was in Sacramento. They said, look, this is going to infringe on an officer's right to privacy. We don't want these cases being tried out there in the media. And then even after the law passed, we saw some pushback from the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Union, the deputies union out there, who filed in court. They said, hey, we need to decide whether or not this law should be retroactive, whether you should be able to access case files that go back further than the start date of the law, which was January 1. So we did just recently learn that that petition to block the opening of records has been denied. So it sounds like we're going forward as written.
Hopefully this aids in your work. How do you think this will benefit the public?
Well, I think in general, in the most idealistic sense, we like to think that better facts, better information will lead to a more nuanced understanding of the truth, of what's really happening. I mean, that's like a journalistic principle, right? And in law enforcement, civil rights advocates and the like say that these types of facts being drawn out will lead to better policy, because if law enforcement is more aware or more accountable to officers that have lied or have repeatedly used force, we may see better decision-making in departments. But I got to tell you, Megan, sometimes there are agencies that are aware of problems that do not act upon the problem. So we will see how, if that idealism plays out. I mean, there could be also very tangible effects for different people. So if we learn more about, say, a case in which an officer was found to have been lying again and again or filed a false police report, I mean, we could see convictions overturned, right? And that could be a very real effect on justice and what we know is true and what we know is not true.
All right, KPCC investigative journalist Annie Gilbertson, thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, LA Unified is the second biggest school district in the country with more than 600,000 students and even more parents who are closely watching what's going to happen with an impending teacher strike next week, planning for how they'll handle the situation with their kids. We'll check in with a couple of them when Take Two returns in a minute.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino in for A. Martinez. The fight between the union representing LA's school teachers, United Teachers Los Angeles, and the LA Unified School District has reached a breaking point. The teachers want more pay, more resources, and smaller classrooms, but officials say the district can't afford to meet all the demands. If an agreement cannot be reached, the first LAUSD teacher strike in nearly 30 years will happen on January 10th. That reality has raised a lot of questions for parents with kids in the system who have to decide whether to send their kids to school or keep them home, and what it could mean for their children's education. To address all this, we're speaking to two parents whose kids attend LA Unified Schools. Brenda Miller has two small children at Arroyo Seco Museum Science Magnet School in LA. Welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
And Evelyn Aleman is the parent of a freshman at Grover Cleveland, a combination charter magnet high school in Reseda. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, Evelyn, your daughter attends Grover Cleveland, which is a charter school that is unionized. Not all charters are. Will you be sending your daughter to school during the strike?
Yes, I will be sending her because, you know, my first duty as a parent is making sure that my child attends school. Making sure that she is in school will ensure that the district continues to receive money. The district has had a really big campaign, attendance counts, to make sure that every kid is in school so that it continues to have, you know, funding to pay for salaries. If it continues to have this funding, then it will eventually have more resources and will be able to better support teachers and students.
What other factors did you weigh making this decision?
It's interesting because I was a teacher's assistant in 1989 when we had the last strike. So was my husband, who was my boyfriend back then. We were both college students, and we felt back then, as we do now, that there had to be other ways to resolve this disagreement between the district and UTLA. At the end of the day, we felt that the children were affected back then in 89. They still are now. We felt that it was disruptive to the school community because it broke a lot of relationships. There was a lot of distrust among the teachers, principal, the parents.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that because have you talked to your daughter about what this experience could be like if she has to cross the picket line herself?
You know, she's 14 years old. At the end of the day, all she wants to do is go to school. She hasn't really thought about what that experience will be like because she's never had to see it. I've had to see it, and I am concerned for her, but not for her safety. I know she's going to be fine. I think she, like me and most other parents, don't want to be in between and want to see a resolution.
All right, Brenda Miller, you have said that you will not be sending your daughter to school if the strike happens. How did you make that decision?
Neither my daughter nor my son, especially my son who's in kindergarten. So I see it as two things. I know that they would be safe on school grounds, but I'm concerned that if I send them to school, they're not going to really have a good educational experience during the strike. There are not enough staff members and substitutes to go around, and our school doesn't have kind of a central place where all the students can be. So I'm thinking about the logistics of the day, and I think that the parents who can keep their kids home make it so that the parents who have to send their kids to school or who want to send their kids to school will have a better experience.
And have you explained to either of your children kind of what this is about?
My kindergartner doesn't quite get it, but my fourth grader does understand. And I talked to her about that it's not just about teacher pay, but it's about other resources for the school. And I see this as a way to support the teachers.
Brenda, I want to ask you about something that Evelyn mentioned, which is that, you know, with the district's limited funding, they've hired substitutes to teach students during the potential strike. And there are funds that are hinged on, you know, students showing up. Keeping your child out of school will potentially cost the district money. So how do you reconcile that aspect of this?
It's just a way of showing the district that we mean business and that we are on the side of the teachers. So I think of it as a short-term taking away of the funds to ensure long-term funding.
Just yesterday, Superintendent Austin Buettner sent a note home to parents saying that the district is still trying to work this out and to avert a strike, but he outlined very clearly the offer that the district already made to teachers, which the union rejected, a 6% pay raise, back pay, $30 million more to reduce class sizes, and more nurses and librarians. Evelyn, what are your thoughts on why that isn't enough?
I don't think it's my call or the call of any parent to say what is enough and what isn't. But it seems to be close to what the union is asking for. I feel like the LAUSD is making an offer. It's making proposals. I'd like to see UTLA step forward and make a similar proposal and work with the district. I'm not seeing that.
Brenda, what was your reaction to the superintendent's, you know, saying that he wanted to avert the strike but making the same offer that's been rejected?
I would agree with Evelyn. I would say that I want to see both sides at the table. I don't want a strike. It just looks like it's more and more imminent. Both sides should continue to work until the last possible moment and try to avert the strike if possible.
We're speaking to LAUSD parents Brenda Miller and Evelyn Aleman about the potential teacher strike on January 10th. And Evelyn, if a strike happens, the plan is to bring in substitutes to help in schools during a strike. A statement from the UTLA noted that those 400 subs are expected to educate more than 600,000 students. How do you feel about that in terms of your daughter's education?
I'm disappointed that the district has to go to those measures. You know, the number one most important resource that LAUSD has is its teachers, and you know, it's in the business of educating children. My daughter goes to one of the largest LAUSD high schools at 3,200 kids. I am concerned about the logistics of it all. I also am concerned about the learning. She's in a very rigorous high school program. If she loses one or two days of school because she's sick, she falls behind a week. We don't know how long the strike is going to last. The last one lasted 9 days, so we don't really have much time to lose in high school.
Brenda, how has this fact played into the decisions that you're making?
It played a huge fact in our decision to not send our kids to school. As I said, our school is kind of a non-traditional kind of bungalow situation, and I don't see how there are simply going to be enough substitutes to go around. I'm especially concerned for my kindergartner and what that experience will be like for him. I'm worried that they're going to just be outside in the lunch area all day because that's the only common area for the students to be in. We won't have enough substitutes to be have them in each individual classroom. And I just don't see what that experience is going to be like and if it'll be a good experience if everybody sends their kids. So I'd rather leave the space for the parents I know who have to send their kids to school because of work obligations.
Staffing and class size has been a central part of these negotiations. Brenda, what's the situation in your kids' classrooms?
My kindergartner has 24 students in his class, and then my fourth grader has 34 students. I think the kindergartner, his teacher is very good at managing and has a teacher's assistant. But once we start getting up into the 34 range, I think it's quite large. And I noticed a big difference between third grade and fourth grade. In third grade, there were three teachers, so three different classes. But in fourth grade, now there are only two teachers. And it just seems like there are just so many kids.
Evelyn, charter schools are front and center in this dispute between the union and the district. It's not part of the contract negotiations, but UTLA President Alex Caputo-Pearl recently asked for an immediate cap on charter schools. He has argued, along with some other people, that charters hurt traditional public schools by tapping into LAUSD's already limited resources. As a charter magnet school parent, what are your thoughts on a cap?
Well, I want to be clear that it's an affiliated charter. It's not an independent charter, and I think that Mr. Caputo-Pearl is referencing independent charters that have their own board and more autonomy. Parents have a choice. The district has a variety of different school models to choose from. Independent charters are a part of that. There's a waiting line to get into Grover Cleveland Charter High School Magnet. My child is in the Magnet School, and there's a waiting line to get into the Magnet. I know that Magnet schools in the district outperform even charter schools. We have a great school model. My question is, why don't we, amplify that? Why don't we extend that, make that a model for other schools to follow? I think that the district has great schools, and I think we need to focus on how to expand those throughout the district and not focus so much on charter schools.
And Brenda, your children also attend a magnet elementary school, which wouldn't be affected by a charter cap. But what are your thoughts on Caputo-Pearl's proposal?
I think that having a charter cap might be a good idea. My daughter attended a charter school in kindergarten, and she had an okay experience, but our overall experience was somewhat negative. I think that if there was more oversight and a little bit more kind of thoughtfulness put into charter growth, and also, as Evelyn said, looking at magnets and their model and the success that they've had across the district, that would probably be a way forward rather than just allowing charters to keep opening up.
One of the issues that the district has brought up is that enrollment at traditional public schools is down because kids are going to alternatives like charters or private schools. That lack of enrollment is one reason the district is struggling with a budget deficit. Evelyn, do you think that there are too many charters?
I don't think the question is whether or not there are too many charters. The question should be, why are parents choosing to leave the district? And they're choosing to leave their local public school and go to a charter because they perceive that the education, the quality of education in the charter may be better than the education their children are receiving in their local school, or that maybe the charter provides or best meets their child's needs. So I think we need to figure out how, or the district needs to figure out how to keep parents happy at their local school.
Brenda, do you think that charters address the issue of enrollment dropping?
I think that sometimes charters do address that. It gives parents a choice if they don't feel that their local school is providing what their child needs. But again, I'm coming from the perspective of having had a bad experience with a charter school. And so I think that charter schools can be part of the problem of kind of draining away students from traditional schools.
There is a lot on the table here between the union and the district: higher salaries, more resources like librarians and nurses in schools, smaller class sizes that we talked about. So to each of you, what is the most significant thing that you think should change in how district schools are run? And what would you want to say to LAUSD's administration? Brenda, I want to start with you.
I think that the focus has often been on just teacher salary, but the school is an ecosystem, and it kind of has a lot of different players, including librarians and teachers' assistants and counselors and nurses and things like that. And in order for it to be a healthy and good environment for learning, we need to think about all of those resources, not just teachers. So I would say focus on the entire experience.
And Evelyn, what would you want to say to LAUSD's administration? What changes you would want to see in district schools?
I'd like to see more autonomy at the local schools, more ability to utilize the funding in a way that each school community feels it's the best way for its students and its families. I'd like to see a focus at every single school on the children and making sure that the school and its community of educators and staff meet the needs of the students. I think that if the students are happy, the families are happy, if they're learning, and they'll want to stay in their local schools and support them.
Brenda Miller and Evelyn Aleman are both parents of LAUSD students. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And to address some of the concerns we heard here on the program tomorrow, we will speak with LA Unified Deputy Superintendent Vivian Ekchian and UTLA President Alex Caputo-Pearl. Coming up later on the show, LA County and the City of Malibu are establishing committees to investigate the response to the devastating Woolsey Fire and what can be done better in a future where wildfires are only expected to get worse. That's when Take Two returns in a minute. You're back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino, in for A. Martinez. Nearly 2 months after the Woolsey Fire broke out, those affected by the disaster are still in the first phases of recovery. But as many work to clean up and rebuild, the City of Malibu and Los Angeles County are launching investigations into the cause of the fire and the response to it. For more on this, we have LA County Supervisor Sheila Kuehl. Thanks for joining us.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me here.
And we also have Rick Mullen on the line, Malibu City Council member and a captain with LA Fire. Good to have you.
Also, thank you very much for having us.
Now, Supervisor Kuehl, before we get into the investigations, can you give us a quick update on recovery efforts from the county's perspective? How is the cleanup going?
Well, it goes slow, of course, because there's so many properties and they have to be evaluated for toxics. They have to be, have to be hauled away by the state if the homeowners have given access to the property and said okay. But we've got our two recovery centers still up and running on both sides of the mountains. We've had thousands of visitors, and also, we pass a number of new issues so that people can live on their property in an RV or a trailer temporarily. We're working with the utilities to get everything back up and running. It's slow, you know, because of all the devastation, but the county, I think, has really stepped up on this.
And Councilman Rick Mullen, speaking both as a firefighter and from the city's perspective, how is Malibu recovering?
Well, I would say the same thing. You know, just to put this in perspective before we get started is, you know, everyone tends to think of these in terms of historical fires. And for Malibu, the last big one was probably the Corral fire. And this fire was, you know, 20 times the size of the Corral fire. So the devastation is significant. And I think everyone's still sort of in a state of shock from the big event, but we're working very hard. And a lot of that work is actually being done by the county, which is the hazmat inspections of the debris removal areas and then the actual debris removal itself. But I want to support something that Supervisor Kuehl said, which is the disaster assistance centers that they set up early and quickly have been a great resource for everybody who's trying to put their lives back together. And I really appreciate how quickly the county moved on putting all those different agencies in one place. And for everyone who's gone in there, they've been super helpful.
All right, Supervisor, I want to talk about the investigation that the county is undertaking. What is it looking into specifically?
Well, I would say investigation is not exactly the right word, because the idea that I had and the motion that was passed last month really has several phases. One of them is to try to work, which has already started, to understand how the fire started and how it spread. And we are going to hire a consultant to look at the allocation of resources and how the sort of instantaneous responses went half hour by half hour. But the major part of what I want to set up and will set up is a large task force to look at how people are notified, how they are evacuated. We want to hear we'll have four public hearings to hear from the public about their experience during the fire. And then a second round of public hearings on repopulation, which is how were you told that you could go back in? Did that work for you or not? Were you confused, or were you getting, you know, different kinds of instructions? When you got back in, was there any support? We want to really understand the experience of the constituents so we can be prepared when the next disaster happens and have better communication, better preparation, better evacuation measures, and across all of my cities up there, not just, Malibu will do this and Calabasas will do that, but let us somehow at least be in communication. That's the main thrust of what we want to do.
And Councilman, what specifically is the city of Malibu planning to look at in regards to its local response efforts?
Well, the scale of what we're going to do is much smaller than the county, of course. They are the primary public safety responders, the county fire department and the sheriff's department, as well as CHP, and they had the lion's share of the physical activity during the emergency response itself. So the post-incident analysis that will be done by the county will be very important for all the residents who are had concerns about anything that happened there. And I think our primary function during that process to support them is to give input from the residents themselves and things they observed and support that sort of after action effort. But as far as what the city is concerned is, we want to look at our evacuation noticing that we did. How efficient was that? Could we do it better? And I think one of the big things is, how do we improve the readiness of the population itself? Not only people's ability to evacuate quickly, but also, why did the homes burn and how can we make them better? Was our brush clearance and the hardening of the homes as good as it could be, as well as the readiness of the individual neighborhoods themselves? There were a lot of people who took action and did some great jobs, and we want to improve the robust robust nature of our CERT team, volunteers on patrol, things like that. The sort of citizen activists that are credentialed and trained appropriately to work in conjunction with the public safety agencies that can be the local area experts in the future and have a better integration with the sheriff and the fire department.
And Councilman, what were the biggest concerns that you have heard from Malibu residents about the emergency response and how it could be improved?
Well, I would say that the lion's share of the concerns fall under three different areas, which is the conduct of the evacuation. In particular, people are very concerned about the traffic jam on PCH.
Mm-hmm.
How can we make that move much smoother? The other one was the fire department resources. You know, why were they? I think people, when they look at the history of Malibu-only fires, as I call them, like the Corral Fire, the 93 fire, they're used to seeing, you know, fire engines all over the place. They want to know why that wasn't the case in this instance. Was it purely the scale of the fire itself that dictated that, or were there other reasons? And a lot of that will come from the county. And then one big source of ire was the whole repopulation effort, as Supervisor Kuehl mentioned. Why couldn't they get back in, or why couldn't they get the right information and all of that? And those three areas really have to do with the sheriff's department and the fire department and our ability to work closely with them. And that's what I think as we go forward as a city, we want to make sure that we can communicate and support their efforts in a way that not only facilitates the responding agencies themselves to do a better job, but to have our citizens understand what is going on and communicate with them, and if possible, get them back in, or at least have them able to move in freely, like the CERT teams and things like that.
Right. The Woolsey Fire was certainly among the most devastating in Southern California, but of course we've known that this is wildfire country for a long time. So, Supervisor, what's new about this effort? Why hasn't something like this been done before now?
Well, I think that people were stunned at the scope of this fire, and also the global warming has made everything tinder dry up there in ways that people, I think, had not really understood. And so much of the fire was spread by Santa Ana winds and sparks, even across cleared areas. So we have to really take a look at what's possible in terms of preventing this kind of devastation. And also, I think at this time, with all the resources that were allocated at the fire in Paradise and several other fires that haven't even been, you know, listed that were going on at the same time, the fact that we rely on mutual support was also something that suddenly we couldn't rely on. We couldn't get all of the other fire departments to come, or the, you know, the National Guard, because many of them were allocated up north. And I think we have to take a look at this as the new kind of situation for us. What do we do about this tinder dry area? What do we do about clearing and preparation? But also, I think we want to look at, you know, what the utilities are doing and can do. But a lot of it is going to come down to each of the individual cities. Several of the cities were devastated by the fire, not as much as Malibu. But in the unincorporated areas up in Malibu Lake and across unincorporated Malibu and unincorporated Calabasas, you know, that's county responsibility. And I want to pull this all together. When people's cell phones don't work, how are they going to tell each other to get out? You know, when a cell tower goes down and everybody says, why doesn't my cell phone work? We may even need to go back to the air raid siren kind of thing. I don't know. But I want to do a really deep dive into preparation, notification, evacuation. You know, everybody said, why didn't we have all the lanes on PCH going south? And I think for a little while, they weren't sure whether they needed to bring fire resources up PCH. So it's, you know, there's a lot to really be learned and understood about it. And it's all about the future. It's all about the next fire.
Well, speaking of the future, what is the next step for the investigation, and kind of what's the timeline to get some lessons learned from this?
Well, I think the county, so far as the county is concerned, we're putting together a task force. We're talking about it this week. There will be a representative from each city, three representatives from the unincorporated areas, and then all the agencies, fire, sheriff, CHP, probably a state representative, maybe the Office of Emergency Services or Cal Fire, and as I said, the Department of Public Works, because they're engaged in the cleanup, and any other departments that we think should be on it. Our first job is going to be the public hearings that I talked about, you know, what worked and what didn't work during the fire. I don't know exactly when those will be scheduled because we have to constitute the task force first, but my staff and I are working, you know, every day on putting this together, figuring out who's going to be on it. I contacted all the cities yesterday. Rick, I spoke to your city manager and put a call into Jefferson as well, and the other cities, Calabasas, Agoura Hills, Hidden Hills, and Westlake Village, plus the unincorporated areas. Then we will probably constitute some ad hoc working groups to look at each individual thing, to work with consultants that the county will hire about best practices and about going forward.
All right, that's LA County Supervisor Sheila Kuehl and Malibu Councilmember Rick Mullen on the county and city's investigation into Woolsey Fire cause and response efforts. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Megan.
Thank you very much.
Coming up next on the show, we're going to check in on the cannabis market in California. Recreational pot, of course, available for the last year. How did sales go? Kind of too mellow. We'll check in on that when Take Two returns in just a minute. Back now with more Take Two. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino in for A. Martinez. It's been just over a year since California began regulating the sale of recreational marijuana, but the rollout has been a bit rocky. Around $2.5 billion worth of legal cannabis was sold in 2018. That's about $500 million less than the year before when just medical marijuana was legal. Oh, and that extra tax revenue pot proponents promised, that came in under state projections too, by about $150 million. So how did we get here, and how might things change in the coming year? Hezekiah Allen was the executive director of the California Growers Association. He now chairs a co-op focused on cannabis production. Welcome to Take Two.
Hey, thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So how would you characterize the recreational pot rollout last year?
You know, it was slower than I think some of the speculators and certainly some of the folks who campaigned for Prop 64 expected. I think that it was, you know, sort of what a lot of people were expecting, though. California has a long history with cannabis, medical and otherwise, and trying to make this transition so quickly was bound to be challenging.
Were you surprised that sales fell short of expectations?
No, not even a little bit. I think those expectations were driven sort of by a green rush, you know, speculative mentality that I don't think many of us really expected to see numbers that high in year one.
What were some of the reasons that these projections for licensed businesses fell short?
You know, I think the big reason here is pretty simple. Markets can't operate without sales, and California has far fewer licensed retailers than there were retailers in previous years. You know, as many, probably as low as 10%. We used to have about 10,000 medical collectives operating under Proposition 215 for the last couple of decades, and we've got less than 1,000 licensed retailers operating. Now, if you think about how big California is, trying to ensure consumers are able to buy cannabis from a licensed shop with only, you know, several hundred, it's just really challenging. It's not convenient for consumers to buy regulated cannabis.
And it's worth mentioning that to some consumers, it's probably not entirely clear which shops are licensed, right?
Oh, I think it's incredibly difficult to tell. You know, you've got some really established businesses that haven't been able to obtain licenses, especially when you talk about delivery services. Unfortunately, most local governments and the state were sort of lagging behind on licensing delivery services, those businesses are super convenient. And yeah, there's really nowhere in the checkout process that a consumer would even know.
Taxes were seen as kind of a big part of this green rush for local governments and the state government. Do you think that taxes in some part might have put a damper on consumers' desire to buy, you know, licensed marijuana?
Oh, I think absolutely. You know, when you go in, consumer goes in to maybe buy $20 worth of product and ends up with a $30 bill, you know, folks notice that. And I definitely think that the tax rate has reduced sales activity. California does have some of the highest tax rates for cannabis for any of the, you know, close to 30 states now that have some form of regulated cannabis. There's communities in California where when you combine the local tax and all of the state taxes, you're looking at an effective tax rate of 50% or more. It's definitely, you know, the price is absolutely pushing folks into the unregulated market.
Looking ahead to 2019, do you see anything happening that could change the landscape a little bit?
You know, I think the biggest factor is just going to be this slow but steady process. As cities and counties figure out that they can't ban cannabis, all they can do is ban regulated cannabis, we're going to see a lot more cities and counties start to regulate this activity. More stores equals more sales. And so things are going to pick up slowly over time. I think, you know, for the new governor's administration, the new legislature coming to work here in the state capitol, you know, I think that tax rate is going to be incredibly important. Is there a way, counterintuitive as it seems, is it possible that reducing the tax rate might actually generate more revenue overall by stimulating the entire market? So big questions up here in the Capitol for sure.
So what do you think could be done if we want to keep the financial benefits of this market coming in while also making sure the proper regulations are in place?
You know, I think at Board of Supervisors, city council level, it really comes down to more stores and more communities throughout California. But I think, you know, the average Californian, you know, who is buying cannabis that's coming from a licensed retail facility, it's taxed, so it's likely going to cost a bit more. But it's also been tested. It's subject to some of the leading consumer safety standards of really any consumer agricultural product in the world. You know, that product is, it's a better product. And so I think consumers can do a lot, too, to choose those regulated products and to be sure to be careful when you know, if they do choose to consume cannabis.
And what about things at the state level, maybe adjustments to the tax rate?
Yeah, I think that's the big one. You know, last year we saw unsuccessful attempts coming out of the state legislature. The governor's administration indicated they maybe weren't that excited about a reduced tax rate. We'll see. It's a new year. There's a new cast of characters up here, and you know, something could get done. I think that's probably the biggest single thing that the state government could do is reduce the tax rate, and hopefully that would lead to more taxable sales. So we actually do think that would generate more revenue for the state.
All right. Hezekiah Allen chairs Emerald Grown. That's a collective that oversees about 130 licensed cultivators. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Hey, my pleasure. Anytime. Be well.
Air Talk with guest host Kyle Stokes is coming up next. Take two. We'll be back tomorrow.